Yeah, that's right.
Floor is yours.
Thank you. Let me know. Can you hear me clearly enough, or should I use the mic?
You should use the mic while we're recording, if we could hear you.
Okay. So, okay. I'm here today for Kingston Village Limited and for Greenvale Station Limited, and I have with me Mike Wilkins, who's the Managing Director of Wilkins Farming Limited, which owns Greenvale Station. So I thought we'd start with the Greenvale Station submission first and hand the floor over to Mike, who will present his statement. And I think you would have been given a...
Yes, we have received that. Thank
okay,
you.
Great.
Okay, thank you, Meg. Yes, my name's Michael Wilkins. I'm the Managing Director of Wilkins Farming, and we're a shareholder and manage Greenvale Station at Kingston. Wilkins Farming is an agribusiness based in Northern Southland, and as a fifth generation New Zealand farmers, we manage the land in a sustainable and responsible way for generations that will follow. We proudly produce high quality livestock crops and are internationally recognised for a number of products that we produce. Greenvale Station is 1,600 hectares in the area, located south of Kingston, with the northernmost boundary joining the Kingston Golf Course, and the station stretches approximately 10 kilometres down the valley to Fairlight. The station runs a mixture of sheep, cattle and cropping. So as shown in the map on the right, the Kingston Flyer Railway Line, shaded blue, runs through Greenvale Station, shaded green, within the Queenstown Lakes District. We farm crops and livestock. While I appreciate and enjoy the idea of the Kingston Flyer as a tourist venture because of its historic connection with the area, I have significant concerns about how it is operated and the fire risk it creates. These concerns are not only based on very recent experiences from when the flyer had trials, but also from incidences during the previous owner's operations. It seems that the flyer has caused many fires in the area over the last 15 years, as various operators have tried to operate the train without starting fires. I recall one incident requiring multiple fire engines and a helicopter to contain control the blaze. On the 2nd of January, which there was a trial run that took place, and I just happened to be driving down the road and would come across the train, and surrounding vegetation was on fire. There were many people who stopped to assist. The rapidly escalating situation, putting themselves at personal risk. This trial was undertaken in the middle of the hot summer, and the crops are dry and therefore more susceptible to fire during the period. The fire started by the trial train operation was not only risked our crops, but also the buildings on our land. And just note, I missed out that along with other neighbouring land. The people who kindly stopped to help, in addition, I was generally concerned that the train itself would be lost due to fire. And that was one of the pictures that I took of the incident on the 2nd of January. And the flames were up on the wooden, on the side, and the people standing, I just thought, actually panicking. Thankfully, more to good luck and good management, the fire was extinguished relatively safely in time. After reflecting upon this incident, I decided to follow up with the owners to understand future plans, because I was concerned for the risk they were creating in the area for all neighbouring landowners, not just themselves. During this call, I expressed my concerns about the potential for the fires to be started on my property, and made it very clear that the field of wheat beside the railway line was nearing harvest, so clearly a huge fire risk and potential financial loss to our business. I was told that there was a further test run planned on the 1st of February, but assured that it was they'd limit the risk to our crops by not travelling the whole distance, but just the first stretch in the QLDC area. I was also advised that the local Kingston Fire Officer would be present to ensure all precautions were being taken to prevent the fire risk, and they would be on hand to put out the fire, any fires, because there was still a risk in these very dry conditions for any fires to spread out of control. On the 2nd, what date was that? Sorry. On the 1st of February, I called Tony Wilson, the local fire chief, which was the day of the next planned trial, to ensure that these procedures were actually put in place. Chief Wilson had not heard from the fire operators and was therefore completely unaware that the train was about to run on that specific day. Frustratingly, the trial took place on the 1st of February and the fire brigade was not on standby as promised. Just at this point, I'd like to delete that sentence, the next one. Because Tony did go down and hit them up and said, look, I'm the only fireman in town, you can't run it. So they still run at 500 metres, as I understand, and stopped. So, and then I'll start back at point 13. If these fires had not been contained, our crops would have been damaged or destroyed, let alone the risk to our buildings and staff. Sorry, just to elaborate back to point 12, the fire on the 2nd of January obviously happened, but there was another run where they went right to Fairlight, and from my knowledge, there was 8 small fires started. So that were managed. But so if these fires had not been controlled, our crops would have been damaged or destroyed, let alone the rest of the buildings and staff. The loss of a wheat crop alone could cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, in the worst case scenario. Understandably, this is a considerable concern for me, given the economic implications for Greenvale Station is significant. Similar fire risks could clearly occur throughout the planned route, which includes Kingston Township, with the train running close to housing. What is particularly concerning is that recent fires occurred during these one-off test runs, so understandably are very concerned about the prospect of the train running more frequently. I understand that over the last 15 years, the flyer has caused multiple fires issues in the area. Our business would face significant risk during the months of December to March, a period particularly given the dry conditions and the stage of our crop growth at this time. While it may be possible for the flyer to run during the winter and spring months, Greenvale Station, like all owners in the affected area, I'd need to be convinced of a comprehensive risk mitigation and fire management plan. Until further work had commenced in this regard, we strongly oppose the operation of the flyer. Sort of the horseshoe that comes around and then hits the hill.
I could show you up on the map if you like.
I think I know what you mean. It's sort of, it's like
where it cuts into the hill, where the track is hard against the hill for that short straight.
And it's at the southern end of that straight that the boundary is.
But we've got a slim sliver of land that runs all the way through behind that and through to the Kingston golf course.
Yeah, it's on the map.
dotted area would be the Queenstown boundary line, I think.
Yeah, I think that's an anomaly.
Is it?
From my understanding, that dotted line is the boundary line.
The dotted line.
Yeah, even though there's some zoning shown
in
Southland.
Yeah,
zoning
in Southland, that's true.
So there obviously is a lot of Greenvale Station that's in Southland as well. And my understanding of the Southland District Plan rules is that there are no rules that control this type of activity. So it's my understanding that it's a permitted activity in Southland District. No, I don't have a summary statement. I did have some notes that I could just read through just to briefly summarise, but if you're happy just to ask questions, then that's fine.
I've read it. I'm happy to just go straight to questions.
Okay, yeah, that's fine.
Question I have for you is that in terms of Mr. Wilkins' concern, Flyer seeking a commercial zoning of two blocks actually in Kingstown, in Kingston rather, and I think commercial zoning over the corridor. Do they need a commercial zoning to run the train down the train line?
Interesting question. I know they have applied for a certificate of compliance, which they've applied for under the existing mix of zones, and there are several zones that apply to the land, and that hasn't been granted yet. There's been a bit of backwards and forwards on that. My view is that it's a commercial recreation activity, so it would need resource consent, and in my view it would be in the rural zone, which a lot of the corridor is zoned rural under the proposed plan, it would be a discretionary activity because there'll be, I expect, more than 12 people on the train in that zone, and it would be a controlled activity if they got the settlement zone with the commercial overlay in the township area.
If they didn't get a commercial overlay in the settlement zone, and it was just settlement zoned over the part within the township, what status is your opinion that commercial recreation is?
It would be non-compliant.
Because there's a lot of people involved.
Because of the settlement zone provisions, commercial recreation activities are non-complying activity.
And you generally said that it's permitted in Southland District?
That's my understanding. I'm not sure the permitted baseline goes across the boundary.
Yeah, but that's the point. Like, the vast majority.
Right.
What's the nature of the station's operations on the Queenstown side of the boundary?
I think they can only turn round at one end, so.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's right. I understand they've got to go
all the way to Feelight to turn round.
Around.
But they've got to go all the way to Kingston to turn round too.
They can't stop the boundary. Yes,
no.
I appreciate that. There is an issue, and so the question is, what's the nature of farming activity on the Queenstown side of the boundary, Queenstown Lakes side of the boundary?
It's only pastoral.
Can I say that covers a multitude of sites?
Yeah, grazing of sheep and cattle. The cropping, grain growing is all down the other end, when I say other end, the other 80% of the farm.
I would add, I don't, a fire probably wouldn't stop at the boundary line necessarily either. And a lot of the cropping is just south. If there was a fire started, despite which boundary it started in, it would.
And the ripening of the crop is in time with the dryness of the nature around it.
Turning as justice to your village issue, I'm not sure if it's what you're raising is a planning issue or a landscape issue. What do you think?
This is in relation to that. Outstanding natural landscape. I think it's actually a mapping error that occurred probably at stage one. And at that time, it was our understanding that if your land wasn't rezoned as part of the proposed district plan, then you didn't have to look at none of the provisions of the proposed plan applied to your property. That understanding has changed in recent court decisions and memorandums that have come out in relation to some of the stage one appeals. So now, my understanding is that some parts of the proposed district plan now apply to your land, even if your land hasn't been rezoned. So my concern is that the O&L landscape area, which is currently over the Kingston Village special zone, may now need to be considered. And as it was removed from the Kingston settlement zone as part of stage three, I think it should have also been removed from the Kingston Village special zone at the same time. I don't think it should have been put there as part of stage one either. That's right.
The problem or the issue that occurs to me is you're effectively inviting us to assume that when the stage of the district plan finally considers that special zone, it will roll it over. Can we make that assumption?
I'd be very surprised if it didn't occur. There's already been stage one of subdivision of that land recently granted subdivision consent. Well, it's 217 residential lots. I can't remember the number of hectares off the top of my head, perhaps 15 hectares?
So
15 hectares approximately.
What proportion of that is that of the whole?
How many lots was the whole?
The whole, it could accommodate around 700 lots, so it's about a quarter of the property.
Just looking at your rebuttal evidence, we have a broader question. I mean, have you had conversations with Mr. Grace and others about what their expectation is? Because I think your evidence is quite clear. You're really saying that the whole use of the Kingston advisory rather intermittent and the zoning wall is not specific to them.
Yeah.
They allow a whole range of activities.
Yeah, that's right.
And therefore, from your argument, it's not appropriate. Have you had much discussion with them?
No, I haven't had a direct discussion with them. I'm just conscious that if it is rezoned to settlement with commercial precinct, there is a range of activities that can occur. I'm also conscious that there's some changes they've proposed to the settlement zone which would apply in other settlement zones across the district. For instance, removing the permitted status of residential activities.
Yeah.
Land wasn't involved in the zoning at the time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, they made no submission whatsoever on stage one. And during the after stage one was notified, the subdivision application was lodged for the subdivision on that land, and the ONL, not like no provisions of the proposed district plan were taken into consideration through that process.
Can you repeat that?
Well, we've done several resource consent applications throughout the district for the land that hasn't been part of the proposed plan since stage one was notified, and no provisions of the proposed plan are
so
taken account of those.
Doesn't something come to light during those subdivision consent applications?
No.
That, oh, we've got an ONL, a proposed ONL over this land.
No, we only noticed it at stage three when it was readjusted, and at the same time there was... It wasn't readjusted over the KVL land, or the Kingston Village Special Zone, but at the same time there was the new framework for the district plans whereby we now have volume A and volume B, and there's some crossover between them now, which wasn't the case.
And that
earlier.
Sort of little schematic of how that works, volume A and B, has only come to light.
Yes.
For this, at this stage.
Yeah, that's right, and it's still going through the court process.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what that means, we're not quite sure yet.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much to you both. I appreciate you coming to talk to us. And,
thank you.
Thank you. Commissioners, I assume you have and have read my submission. And what I'm concerned about is, and I'll acknowledge at the outset that there's a degree of personal concern here. I have a thing about the extent to which the RMA and its administration keeps adding regulation and cost and complexity that is not warranted. Yeah, I'll be interested to see how much older I am before that becomes law. Whatever. And this is just a small instance which led me to lodge this objection, and it relates to five rules all worded the same way. And it relates to rule 21.7.5, point one, which is the requirement to maintain a water supply for firefighting purposes. If you look at rule 21.7.5.1, I've got copies of it if you want me to hand it around, but I assume you can. Right. So 27.5.1 and the underlining and cross outs the amending. So you can see that before the amendment it said a water supply of 45,000 litres I think that's all it said. A water supply of at least 45,000 litres. It's not at least, a water supply of 45,000 litres. Now, if you excuse a bit of history, back in the day, until the district plan was notified, there was a requirement to have 20,000 litres of water for firefighting purposes. No reference to potable water supply. And if you're interested, the 20,000 litres was 14,000 litres for firefighting, and 6,000 litres was 6 days at 1,000 litres a day for potable water supply, because the council thought, well, if you've got a rural property and you're relying on a pump and a bore, sometimes the pump breaks down, sometimes you've got problems with the bore, and they had a rule that gave you 14,000 for firefighting storage and 6,000 litres a day at 6,000 litres at 1,000 per day for potable. When the district plan was notified, the 20,000 jumped to 45,000. I don't know why. I don't know what study was done that said the $20,000 was insufficient. I think I read something about a fire service recommendation. I think it was one of those national kind of fire service standard. They increased it to 45,000, so every council is now increasing it to 45,000. I make that point because I doubt, and I'm going to come back to this, I doubt there's anything magic about the figure of 45,000. I mean, it could be 44 or 43 or 46. It's just a standard. So it became 45,000. And now we have the variation to stage three, which has added in excluding potable storage volume requirements for domestic use. And I lodged to have those words in brackets. My submission seeks those words in brackets be deleted. The Section 32 report, one of my reasons was there is no storage requirement for domestic potable water supply. You've got to have a supply, you don't have to store it. The 32 report accepts that little point and deletes the word storage.
I think you
mean the 42A report. Recommends deletion of the word storage because there is no storage requirement. That doesn't actually address my submission. So it now says excluding potable volume requirements for domestic use. My first issue with that is I'm not sure what it means. Because if it says at least 40, there's two ways you could read it. You could read it a water supply of at least bracket 45,000 litres minus potable volume requirement, close bracket. So the total is 45,000, but it's made up of a little less than 45,000 for fire storage plus a bit for potable. Or it can be read at least 45,000 litres bracket plus potable volume requirements for domestic use. You could read it either way, I think. Now, the first option would be a nonsense because it doesn't change the meaning of the rule. Like if you put the words in brackets in or take them out, the total is still 45,000 litres. So I assume, therefore, the first way you could read it is not the way it's meant to read. I assume it's meant to read of at least 45,000 litres plus potable volume requirements for domestic use. And my issue here is, if that's the way it's meant to read, then, well, it adds cost. You've got 45,000 litres, you can get a 20,000 litre tank and a 25,000 litre tank. You need another tank of X, or you need to push the 20,000 up to 20. You've got two 25s to cover it. But either way, it costs money. I mean, if you get another tank and get it plumbed, a little 2,000 or whatever, get it plumbed and put in, you won't have any change out of $1,000. So you're putting a cost of maybe $1,000 on everybody who builds a house, just because of those words. The second problem is, if it's plus potable volume requirements for domestic use, what does that mean? Because then you have to know what, well, the next problem is, if it's plus potable volume requirements, it is actually adding a requirement to store potable water. Because you're adding the 45,000 plus something, so your tank gets bigger. So you're now being required to store potable water when you never had to store potable water before. The third problem is, what is the figure? Now, if the lady, sorry, I don't know the name. I need to hand out one piece of paper. Then try and find out what the potable volume requirement is you have to add to your fire storage. All I could find, top rule on that page, 27.7.16.3, which is in the district-wide subdivision and development under services and facilities and utilities, where no communal-owned and operated water supply exists, all lots other than lots of access roads, blah, blah, shall be provided with a potable water supply of at least 1,000 litres per day per lot. Now, the wording is interesting. No communal-owned and operated water supply. If you go to the basin, Wakatipu Basin, probably three-quarters of the houses are on one of the half-dozen communal-owned water supplies. There's Dale Field, there's Hawthorne, there's two or three others. And the other, maybe 20, I don't know, I'm guessing here, but say 20, 25% are on individual bores. They have their own bore. So the houses that have their own, the individual ones, have to have a supply of 1,000 litres a day under the district plan. The communal-owned and operated water supply, there is no district plan requirement for potable water supply. Because this rule is actually irrelevant, because the council takes its potable water supply requirements from its engineering standard, which sits outside the district plan, and for the last 15 to 20 odd years, if you're doing a house in the basin, you have to have a water supply of 2,100 litres a day. That's the standard requirement always imposed. So I don't even know why they put this rule in the plan, because the council reads at least 1,000 litres to mean 2,100, and it applies that to every rural property, whether it's got it on a communal-owned water supply or not. Which brings me to my first problem, is I have a memory, and I'm sure Commissioner Robinson will probably correct me if I'm wrong, that there's a legal problem with having a standard in a district plan that can be varied in a document outside the district plan on an annual basis. Like, the council can change its engineering standard. It could shift the 2,100 to 2,500 or back down to 1,500 or 1,000 at any time. And I think there's a legal issue about having a district plan rule, the effect of which can be varied outside the plan. But yeah, whether it's 1,000 or 2,100, that's when I say, why? Where's the justification? Where's the Section 32 analysis that justifies that extra cost? Because if you think about it logically, now I'll take a step back. I assume you know how the system works. I've got one of them at home. I've got the 20,000 litre tank, and at the top of the water there's a round ball that floats up and down, and it floats down a bit, and it triggers the pump, and the trickle water comes in and fills it back up again. So you've got to maintain your, what was 20, now 45,000 litres, and the little lever thing does it on the basis that, yeah, on a hot Saturday, you're irrigating your garden, and you're out there working, and your two kids are off doing recreation, and there are three showers in the evening, and you know, you've probably drawn your 20,000 or 45,000 litre tank down by 1,000 litres during the day, and it triggers the little trickle supply, and overnight it pushes it back up to 45,000 litres again. That's how they all work. So you have a situation where, you know, that happens, and, you know, let's say the fire happens just after the three showers, at the end of Saturday, before the overnight refill comes, kicks in. So you get that, get really unlucky, you've got 44,000 litres of firefighting water, not 45,000 litres of firefighting water. What's the difference between 44,000 and 45,000? You know, where's the need to add this little extra bit on? The other point I make in my submission is, you know, you need the 45,000 litres for firefighting and 1,000 or 2,100 for storage. You're not going to need them both at the same time. You're not going to be in the shower when your house is burning down. It's just kind of, where's the logic? I don't understand why this change has been put in. I don't understand why you load another $1,000 on the cost of every house just to achieve a situation where you've got, if the fire happens to strike, you've got 45,000 litres rather than 44,000 litres or 43,500. It's never going to be anything lower than about 43 and a half or 44 if the fire hits at the worst time. Otherwise, you've got your 45. Now, if you remove those words in brackets, the excluding potable storage volume requirements for domestic use, you solve all of the problems that I've just outlined. You've got to have fire storage of 45,000. Your 45,000 doubles as storage for your potable, because it does. The potable water supply always comes in through the fire storage tank. And then the district plan says that there must be potable water supply. And the council's engineering standard, which sits outside the district plan, says how much potable water supply you have to have. And council can set it at 2,100 or 1,500 or 3,000 on an annual basis as it sees fit. So you don't have a rule in the plan dependent on a document outside the plan. It's clear, it's 45,000 litres, 20,000 tank and a 25,000 tank. And everybody saves themselves $1,000. Correct. So I'm only talking about new houses. I wasn't suggesting that every existing house had to retrofit. I'm only talking about new development. And I'm sure there will be quite a few new houses built in the rural areas of the Waikato Basin. I'm sorry, of the Queensland Lakes District over the next however many years. Yes, it is. No, it doesn't. No, that's part of my point.
Yes, so you've got a storage volume and you've got a flow volume, yeah. And somehow you're supposed to work out what that additional storage should be.
Yes. 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 And I also meant to say, interestingly, the 1,000 litres a day, that's from back in the day. It was always 1,000 litres a day per day. And in fact, if you go up and down the country, most of the engineering standards, most of them say around about 700 or 800 litres a day is enough for potable water supply for a house. Except in Auckland, where I read in a recent High Court judgment about cloud storage water permits, that the average use in Auckland is 300 litres a day. But most of them say 700. 1,000 is kind of generous, except if you want to know, the reason the council increased it from 1,000 to 2,100 is because of some lot of large properties around Lake Hayes who irrigate, and they use the potable supply for irrigation. So the council lifted everybody to 2,100 to cover irrigation of gardens through very dry summers here.
Beautiful point of all water, green wells.
Exactly. Yeah. We don't have control meter controls in the Queensland Lakes District yet.
Can I just put one word on that?
Yeah.
I think the 42A, the lodge 42A report is to address the point Commissioner Wilson's making, that you could have a continuous potable supply flow and no storage.
Mm. Yes. No, and it doesn't achieve any, it doesn't solve any of the other issues.
Any other questions? One the change from 20,000 to 45,000 litres of storage. Now, you, in your written submission, suggest that there's no evidence. Have you turned your mind to any explanation?
No, sorry. I'm not challenging the 45.
Okay.
I can't, because that's actually a stage one decision, which was never appealed. So the 45 is locked in. Yes.
Would that be the case if there was an alteration or a condition? So if you, for example, had the new definition of a household unit put on a granny flat, would you then have to put on an extra 25,000 litres of water storage?
Well, it would be a discretionary... would it be a discretionary? That would depend upon the status of the granny flat. I think you're allowed a granny flat as of right up to a certain area under the rules. So if you can build a granny flat without resource consent, I don't think they could change the requirement under the district planning rule. They might be able to under their engineering rules, because the council applies its engineering rules as well. So if the granny flat required a discretionary activity consent, then there'd be full discretion, and water supply is one of the issues of discretion. So
70 square metres. And you managed to persuade us that it should be 150 square metres in the rural areas, Mr. Goldstein.
That's right.
I seem to recall.
That's right, yes. But regardless of what the plan says, the council's got its engineering standards, and if the engineering standard says you need more water for a granny flat, I don't know whether it does or not, then you'd have to comply with the engineering standard.
Thank you,
Mr. Rock. Commissioners?
Yes, that's right. I don't have anything to add to my submission, so I'm quite brief and really just went there to serve you, to update you. So I suggest that Mr. Vivian start. He's got a brief summary, and then we can move on to Ms. McKenzie after that.
Thank you. I've just got a summary statement of my evidence. I can probably skip through the primary evidence. You'll understand what the submission seeks and the issues raised in the rebuttal evidence, and go on to the most important part, which is the post-circulation of the rebuttal evidence and where we've got to. So I'll start at paragraph 12. Following the receipt of the rebuttal evidence, Ms. Grace and I met with the view of trying to resolve the outstanding issues in relation to the proposed zoning. That meeting and ongoing discussions has culminated in an agreement in principle between, that should be Ms. Grace and myself, as to the most appropriate zone provisions for the Mingawira Rural Visitor Zone. Ms. McDonald has attached the agreed provisions to her legal submissions, and that's with Ms. Grace's approval. As discussed by Ms. McKenzie, this is based on a number of defined or activity areas within the lower sensitivity landscape of the subject site, which direct where and the amount of development that can take place in the proposed zone. A number of bespoke provisions also direct how much visitor accommodation and commercial recreation activity can occur within the zone as of right, before requiring a discretionary or non-compliant resource consents when and if the permitted activity levels are ever exceeded. As stated in Ms. McDonald's legal submissions, there are two issues Ms Grace and I are yet to resolve. The first relates to proposed rule 465Y7, which relates to the building coverage in activity area G. This is by far the largest activity area within the lower sensitivity landscape area, within which building coverage is restricted to 500 metres square total. The outstanding issue in activity area G includes an existing farm building, which is 352 metres square, which the submitter has applied to extend to 592 metres square. My preference is to make the 500 metres square building coverage in addition to the existing or new farm buildings within the activity area G, noting that any such farm buildings are required to obtain a restricted discretionary activity consent pursuant to Rule 4647. The second issue is the spatial extent of the activity areas themselves. As stated in Ms. McKenzie's summary, these activity areas are all located within the lower sensitivity areas of the property. As explained in Ms. McKenzie's summary, these areas were largely informed by the location of consented rural visitor activities, future activities envisaged by the landowner, and to some extent the topography of the site. I also note activity areas retain the best land for farming cropping, which is important to the visitor experience sought in the zone, provide generous setbacks from neighbouring properties, and greater setbacks from the terrace edge. Mr. Jones has seen an earlier similar version of the activity areas plan, but not the version attached to Ms. McDonald's submissions. And then I just have a table there just working out the development potential of the zone. So the zone in total is 115 hectares. And the rules would allow development potential up to approximately 0.46% of the land area, so less than 0.5%. And I've broken that down into the landscape sensitivity areas and further broken it down into the activity areas. So I just thought that might be useful for you.
Who am I asking questions of?
I think it's Mr. Wilkin. Or
legally.
Or council, I'm sure.
But is Ms. McKenzie going to come
next?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, all right. So, Mr. Levine, I was going to ask this on the legal submissions, but I can ask an interview. Have the landscape architects been involved in the mapping and the building coverage and the discussions between the two parties, between the council and the applicant? Has it just been you and Ms. Grace?
Ms. Grace has consulted with Mr. Jones and I have consulted with Ms. McKenzie. So they have been involved in the process, but it was only Ms. Grace and I that met.
All right.
The maximum.
It's just I had a note of 6,000.
My evidence requested 6,000.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that the actual submission had a figure in it. I'll have to double check that.
Okay, I'll just
make sure. Yeah. This doesn't exceed what I requested in the submission. It's slightly less. The building coverage is 5,500.
Wasn't it 6,100?
Well, that includes the existing farm building on the property. So.
But the rules. Well, I suppose that's a moot point.
Yeah.
Whether it's slightly over or slightly under, depending on whether that is captured by the rule or was always intended to be captured by the rule.
Yeah, that's correct.
Area G is by far is the balance, basically, isn't it? It's
correct.
The west of the 115 hectare property that's not in the more defined areas.
Yes.
So, I mean, we've been asking other standards about
Yes.
And what's the scope of controlled intimacy in reality to manage the location, even though it says the word location in the list of methods of control?
Yes, well, I guess the benefit of the regime that we have in front of you is the site has already been analysed in terms of its landscape sensitivity, so it's that 500 is only going to go in an area of low landscape sensitivity as a controlled activity. If it was to go in high or the medium area, then it would be non-complying or discretionary. But yeah, knowing that site, you could, and with the provisions, the 6 metre height limit on buildings, you could probably put a building, just about a 500 square metre building, anywhere there, and it would be absolutely fine in my view.
Okay, so really, so it comes down to the fact that if it doesn't, you know, if the council doesn't have the ability to control it being on one side of the area G to the other side, or whatever,
yeah.
You're saying it doesn't matter.
I don't think so. Not.
But that's not.
But I think
his view, was it on his original assessment, was that the area was so large?
Yeah, but the original assessment didn't have the activity areas that are now defined.
It was about 6,000 square metres.
Yes. And he was, I understand he was concerned that, you know, that could be one building, for example, which isn't the intention, and that's why we have proposed the activity areas. And broken the coverage up essentially to fit the activity areas.
Okay. I understand that. Thank you. Just looking, you've still got a limit on the number of overnight visitor numbers.
Yes.
But as I understand,
yes,
that
that's correct.
Give a little bit of direction about that, and then I'd like to turn to it. Is it my understanding that the reason for having a limit on overnight businesses is to limit the effects on surrounding neighbours?
I don't think on surrounding neighbours.
Because my question was going to be, before I saw the policy, why do you need that?
Well, I think the reason was to appease the planning officer's concerns that otherwise it could be unrestricted development, you know, visitor activity development. So it's just putting in a threshold for, in terms of the activity, you know, you're permitted up to that point, and then after that you have to go through a resource consent process to consider.
To not degrade the level of amenity in the surrounding environment.
That's
removing the policy by managing
the
number of overnight guests. So I guess it's not just neighbours, as I summarised it. But it is amenity.
Yes.
There's an amenity.
Yes.
Concern. And same with the number of commitments. So how have you assessed the increase from 30 as notified to now 135 people for commercial recreation, and whether it would degrade?
As I explained in my primary evidence, I have a real difficulty with the wording of the commercial recreation rules, which refer to a number of people in any one group, and you know, properties of this size could have several commercial recreation activities happening at the same time. Therefore, there could be multiple groups of up to 30 people. 30 people could be riding bikes in one group, and 30 people could be in hot tub. And it's very difficult to know if that complies with the rules. Under the operative plan, the council have interpreted a very similar worded rule, that the group refers to the site. So any more than in the rural area, for example, any more than five people undertaking commercial recreation activities on a site require a discretionary consent. So I've tried to change that here by having a maximum number of people
on the site.
On the site that can be undertaking commercial recreation activities at any one time. And then, and that certainly, I think, is far more suitable to a rural visitor zone.
Okay. Thank you for that. Concerns about this sort of zone. One thing we've been asking, we asked yesterday, the planners for another site outside of the O&L, and potentially not that remote, is what. Explain to me the planning implications and how you've evaluated those across the district of opening up the RBZ to our areas outside the O&L, which is the RCL plus the Wakatipu Basin, to only maybe generally remote or maybe not that remote areas, that could meet the RCL landscape test, in other words, maintain landscape character and visual amenity values. Because this is not just a series, it's not just people asking for a series of maps, zoned areas. It's actually causing the whole zone purpose and objectives and policies to be changed. And that has implications across the whole district, not just for the site, which no one has really evaluated.
Yeah.
But it's part of the Section 32. What does it mean for the district in the long run to have a zone of this nature that can be picked up? We've already got 14 different submissions asking for zoning, and over the life of the plan, potentially
get
hundreds more.
Traditionally, in the operative district plan, the rural visitor zone hasn't been restricted to O&Ls. So,
I'm not wanting to know about the old one. I'm wanting to know about this one.
Right. Okay.
This one was notified as being restricted to O&Ls, and including your client submission and your evidence as accepting that it could be spread anywhere in the district. In the
I don't accept that it's appropriate to spread it anywhere.
How is it to be limited, and what are the implications of whatever limitations there might be? That there are other sites that it could apply to.
Yeah. I guess a strong there is the fear that people could use the rural visitor zone to obtain residential development rights. So by retaining non-complying activity for residential activities, could be seen as a way of limiting the desire for people to have the zone.
Yes, and I noticed that your client is no longer asking for
climbing
house on the site.
Yes. My client wants to live on the site and undertake the activity, so essentially they become staff accommodation.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Okay. So that is one way of limiting the desire to have.
Yes.
But it doesn't limit the sites that could meet the requirements and have district accommodation and recreational activities.
I guess the second method is the the low, medium, high sensitivity landscape mapping. There aren't going to be many sites in the district that meet the criteria for low sensitivity mapping.
How can you say this? I mean, I've already asked Mr. on the Wokatip side. I'll ask him again over here. But
well, I guess what I'm.
What basis are you saying that? Have you assessed that?
No.
Have anyone assessed
that? I guess in terms of the Wakatipi Basin, the landscape assessment for the Stage 3 plan change or Stage 2 plan change may have assessed that to some extent.
But what about the
Nā Kōkua? No. My understanding is that the council are looking at doing a similar study over there.
Similar to the Wakatipi Basin?
Yes, yeah. Yes, but that hasn't been done yet.
There are all sorts of parts in the Upper Clusa that not on main road there, like this, or have a bit of a rolling hill in front of them.
And perhaps if there is a desire to undertake rural visitor activities in those areas, and you can get through a plan change process, then maybe it is appropriate.
So what are the implications of that?
Well,
I think
the implications are a good thing. It allows rural land to diversify, and secondly, traditionally, sites like this would be subdivided up into probably 20 sites and have rural living on them. In this case, the zone is taking a different direction. That's not all bad. Yes, there are. Yes.
So would you like to tell me about that?
Well,
quite specifically, because when I look at the rural zone, there are all sorts of policies that talk about visitor accommodation.
Well, for example, the commercial recreation rule is limited to five people.
Only as a permissive activity. Beyond that, it's a discretionary.
Discretionary, yes.
So, I mean, we understand that there will be discretionary activities involved here.
But
VA is discretionary, commercial activity would be discretionary.
Yeah. I guess the point that I made in my evidence is the council, when you lodge an application, they look at it and say the plan allows 12 people for commercial recreation activities, that is appropriate for the whole site, no more.
So why is a discretionary activity seen as a complete barrier, given that most things are discretionary in the rural areas of this district?
Yes, and
even the subdivision's discretionary, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and I guess there is still the perception from the ODP that even though it's discretionary, development is inappropriate in those areas.
Yeah. Well, that's not a true test, is it?
Well, in terms of the ODP, it is.
Yeah,
it's written into the ODP.
Yeah, I'm looking for an objective or a policy that says visitor and accommodation and commercial recreation greater than 12 people in the group is inappropriate in the rural zones. And it just doesn't seem to stay there.
Yes. I haven't got the rule provisions before me, but consenting in the rural environment is very, very complicated. It's costly and it's very time consuming in this district. Even very simple things, they do cost a lot. The threat of notification in the Upper Clutha, a notified application just about in most cases will end up in the Environment Court. It's very, very difficult to develop in the rural area.
So is that really the number of it? Because that's what we've heard has worked for others, that even though there's a discretionary activity pathway with, say, reasonably supportive policies, certainly not policies that express a complete barrier, time and cost.
Mm. Yeah, time and cost.
Of anything that's notified needs to be replaced by zone.
Well, not anything, no. But for where you have a situation where the activities undertaken on a piece of land that meet the criteria for a rural visitor zone,
the submitter's version of it doesn't mean the notified rural visitor zone.
No, yeah, correct. If
you can change the zone enough to allow your site to be compatible, then that's better than having a notified, than the cost and delay or
And the certainty for how that landowner wants to develop their land.
But where does that end up? There's a policy here that says provide for the establishment of activities such as tourism and visitor accommodation within farms where the landscape values can be sustained in the long run. It's quite a positive policy in the rural zone.
Yes, but then there'll be other policies there that talk about built form in the environment, in the rural landscape, and probably use the words avoid. So,
like what?
I don't have them in front of me at the moment, but.
No, don't worry. What about something like quarrying or some of these other activities that are discretionary?
Mm. Still very difficult to consent anywhere.
So do they need a zone as well?
Well, some of them may be designated, but no, they don't need a zone. The way I look at it, they are smaller, more discrete activities, where what we're proposing here is a lot wider in terms of the activities that are proposed.
But is the rural visitor zone supposed to be limited in extent and scale?
Yes, and the rules do that.
Mm.
But combined, that is a lot wider than just, say, a quarrying activity.
So just let's bring this to an end. In terms of appropriateness of the zone, when you look at the costs and benefits,
yes,
you're weighing heavily the costs of a discretionary activity application in this rural zone.
Not just discretionary, but non-compliant activities as well.
But we're not talking about that here, are we?
Some aspects of what they propose on their property would be non-compliant. I haven't got the rural chapter, so
okay.
I can't answer that. I thought the threshold on commercial recreation activities went to non-complying as opposed to discretion. Yeah. So certainly as we get rid of the ODP, things will become easier because there's a lot more non-complying activities in the ODP. But
Area G, whether you consider new and both existing and new farm buildings.
Yes.
Just as a matter of principle, I can understand that you might specify a limit on existing farm buildings. But what's the shouldn't your assessment
Yes, that's something that Ms. Grace and I were yet to iron out. I did suggest to her that it could have an upper limit for activity area G, including farm buildings, and that was something that she was considering.
Just a couple more things, Carol. You lodged the submission on behalf of your parent investment.
Yes.
And the submission's quite clear about what you were seeking. So, presumably, you looked at that. Your idea, your view, was that the notified zone was far too narrow.
In terms of its location in Owen Isles, yes. And in terms of some of the provisions, yes. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So here's and this product was coming from 500 square metres, which, as I read it, was always intended because of the small scale to keep these things small and discreet. And as the question I posed to you yesterday, the same thing again with Hero and others, and now looking at a whole range of other bespoke provisions, and I think you've got your table of sense out. I think it's a layout of about 5,500 square metres.
Yes. The 500 square metres wasn't notified. There was a notified rule that says buildings in excess of 500 metres square were restricted discretionary activity. Yes, yes, and that rule was notified, and we don't have any issue with that. The 500 was in relation to Ms. Gross's Section 42A report, which for new zones, not the notified zones. And yeah, in my view, that 500 metre square for a zone is very inefficient.
For me, the question is always a bit about, and Commissioner Hall posed it, is the zone fit for purpose. And your submission and the submission of Mel does seem to suggest modification of bespoke roles, differentials, and the issue I'm wrestling with is the zone itself in terms of its application here, maybe the remoteness of the application that's being proposed, but we end up with this as a district-wide zone.
Hmm.
So the nub of it and the question being, if it was, is the zone and being fit for purpose, then that it has to be modified so much.
Well, I don't consider there's a lot of modification here. We're talking about four or five discrete rules and one policy. Certainly, I think if you wanted to approve the zone without those rules, that would be fine. There's still enough control there, but not as much control as we are proposing.
But I think what the Commissioner is saying is not just the additional policy that you're talking about now,
mm-hmm.
but all the changes that have been made through the 42A,
right.
which you now rely on. If you understand, like,
yeah.
your client and others have led to, the client's submission now, have led to a massive change in all sorts of parts.
Mm. Right.
I mean, and again, looking at the application specifically, I applaud your clients for what they're doing, how they're doing it, and how they're coming about it. But this, and you alluded to the fact, for example, in the Upper Clutha, there is a land use study that's about to.
I don't see this zone as being any different to any other zone. That has been through this district plan review. A lot of zones have bespoke rules relating to certain areas of land within the zone. It's in a district like Queenstown, you are going to get people utilising the first schedule process, making submissions and seeking alternative zones or rules or objectives and policies for their properties. And they are entitled to do that.
I'm just looking for some sort of guidance in terms of a landing with because it has been modified quite substantially, it will continue to be, I'm just looking for professional advice on the guidance and moving forward in terms of a landing. And you yourself alluded to the fact that there's a fear that the RBZ could be used to obtain residential activities.
Yes, and that is why I understand that it is proposed to make it non-compliant with strong policies that talk about a void.
One question that I've asked before and I'll ask again because it needs to be asked. For specifics in terms of the number of overrides, how is that enforceable? How is that? you're relying on the good nature of the applicant.
Yes, you're relying on the applicant to do the right thing. There is other external factors such as insurance, for example, which would and also the enforcement department of the council. If I had a hearing last week on a lifestyle precinct, which was identified in the land use capability study, brought into the Waikato Basin amenity zone, and it's still as difficult as ever. A lifestyle precinct which has no submission, no appeals against it, the council still notify it, all of the neighbours oppose it, and you're pretty much back at square one. So, to date, it hasn't.
And you alluded to the this process gives some surety and impediment to significant cost in a resource consent process. Could you expand on the cost?
Well, the cost, for example, we applied for a certificate of compliance for 5 hot tubs in Area C. The cost to apply for a certificate of compliance and get that processed was probably upwards of $15,000, which is, you could have bought 2 of the hot tubs for that amount. The second consent that we've applied for was 8 hot tubs in Area F. Again, that was probably $20,000-$30,000. And then on top of that is on top of the planning costs, there's also building consents that have to be applied for, and roads have to be upgraded to meet the council standards. So there's enormous cost in developing activities such as this.
Yeah. I mean, that is part of the process.
Mm.
You touched on remote versus generally remote yesterday, and this particular site, could you give us your insight into that?
Yes, it's certainly, when you're up on the site, it does have a sense of remoteness from just about anywhere, because you can't see any surrounding development. To a rural visitor, it certainly would be considered remote, in my view. And to local people that use the site now, domestic tourists, it's considered remote as well.
Yes, it is, but it's so very subjective.
Yeah, it is. It is very subjective. But I think the important thing is, if remoteness is a criteria, I think it should be a sense of remoteness. And this property certainly does have a sense of remoteness.
Thank you.
I'm aware we're running over time, so I'll quickly read through my summary of evidence. As you're aware, the relief that is sought enables a node of development associated with rural visitor activities within the site that would consist of general farming activities, visitor accommodation, commercial activities, ancillary to the visitors' accommodation, and built form, including staff accommodation. A landscape sensitivity map submitted with my primary evidence identified areas of high landscape sensitivity, areas of moderate to high landscape sensitivity, and areas of low landscape sensitivity. And I understand that built form would be non-complying in the high landscape sensitivity area, discretionary in the moderate to high landscape sensitivity area, and controlled in the low landscape sensitivity area. I consider that the Mangawera RVZ can absorb this development associated with the RVZ without compromising the landscape character or visual amenity values of the site and its surroundings, particularly within the low sensitivity area, due to the visual containment and the existing landscape character surrounding. Subsequent to my evidence, as Mr. Vivian alluded to, landscape sensitivity areas have been further refined. This refinement is in response to Ms. Grace and Mr. Jones's rebuttal evidence. Mr. Jones raised concerns about the extent of the low landscape sensitivity area in relation to the proposed controls and the proximity of the low sensitivity area to the edge of the escarpment. The landscape sensitivity maps have been updated to include a 25-metre setback from the edge of the escarpment and the identification of 7 activity areas, activity area A to G, within the low sensitivity landscape area. An updated map of the site, including the setback and activity areas, is attached to Ms. McDonald's legal submissions. The activity areas have been identified to restrict the built form with to specific locations within the low sensitivity landscape and give a clear idea of where development will be concentrated. The activity areas were largely informed by the location of consented rural visitor activities and future activities envisaged by the landowner and to some extent the topography of the site. To ensure development is appropriate in scale and a combined maximum total ground floor area of the buildings was proposed for each area, and these were summarised by Mr. Vivian. I stand by my primary evidence and consider that the site has the capacity to absorb additional development as enabled by the Mangawira RVZ. The development anticipated by the revised proposal is more refined with more controls on built form than the proposed relief assessed in my primary evidence. As such, lesser effects are anticipated than assessed in my primary evidence, and I consider that the development enabled by the currently proposed relief can comfortably be absorbed without an appropriate effects on landscape character or visual amenity.
So, just to clarify, have you and Mr. Jones, have you reached agreement on these areas, A to G? Is that
not,
one that you haven't reached?
Not currently, no. So, We proposed an initial set of activity areas, and Mr. Jones came back and asked for them to be further refined, which we did, and he hasn't responded to those as of yet.
So if you and Mr. Jones don't reach agreement,
yes,
this is your evidence
yes.
in terms of your assessment of those areas.
Yes.
And that you're saying you've done your original assessment, which is for the whole area. He came back and didn't see it.
Yeah.
But you stand by your original evidence, and now you're saying, well, it's much more confined now before it's better.
Yes. Yes, so I think there's two elements to the remoteness, is that remoteness refers to kind of distance from things and also the perception of how remote you are. So in terms of this site, obviously it's not that far away from the township of Wanaka or Albert Town. However, when you stand on the site, because of the confined topography, you can't see those things. You can just see the extent of the mountains, therefore you get the feeling of remoteness. So it's kind of it's a two-way street, depending on which way you look at remote.
And is that where you agree with Mr. Vivian, that it's that sense or perception
yes.
of remoteness that's the key for this zone?
In my opinion, yes, that's the key
so
to the zone.
So what is it about having a sense of remoteness that makes an RV zone fit for purpose?
Well, I think that's the intention of the zone, is for it to be a rural visitor's zone as opposed to just being in town, and that's the sense of the remoteness is what makes it unique and encourages people to go there, and that's kind of what our district stands for.
And is it the sense of remoteness that allows on-site custodial accommodation?
In what sense, sorry?
For example, there's a specific rule that says in these areas, which would be remote, whatever that means, you're allowed to have on-site custodial accommodation. How does that relate to a sense of remoteness?
I'm unsure how
doesn't
that... No.
Okay. Alright, so if you... You've heard me ask Mr. Vivian, when you obviously work in this area and perhaps have worked in Upper Clutha or other areas of the district that aren't O&L,
retain landscape character and visual amenity values and have some areas of low visual sensitivity or landscape sensitivity?
Yes.
I mean, have you thought about that?
No, not until today. However, I do agree with Mr. Vivian in his comment that it's not necessarily a bad thing to be able to diversify rural areas into rural visitor zones.
That's
another
question.
Yeah.
But you haven't thought about, you know, what areas and how
they're
flat or
not specifically, no.
No,
not outside this area.
No. Do you accept that there may be other places?
I do accept that, yes. It's further refined it to mean that the potential effects in terms of built form are going to be lesser. However, I think due to the topography and the location of the low sensitivity area on the top of the escarpment, it would have been acceptable either way in terms of landscape.
And just in terms of has used the landform?
To some extent, the main driving factor behind the concentration was the landowner's desire to concentrate nodes of activity in each of those areas. I think generally remote kind of dumbs down the remoteness, so generally remote allows more scope for areas.
Thank you.
Generally sense of allocated the last 3 years and $3 million of our money, and I understood I got to speak in these proceedings.
I think it's something you need to talk to us about.
Yes. Yeah, we'll do that. Thanks.
I appreciate
that.
Time,
yes.
We haven't spent, but
yep.
If you
for your accommodation.
So the commissioner sort of received a some legal submissions. Trust that they got through. Okay, I do have some hard copies here. So I have with me Mr. Freeman, planner. Rebecca Lucas, landscape, and Jason Bartlett, traffic. They each have a single page to read and then obviously answer any questions. with your leave, sir, I won't propose to go through my legal submissions. You've had a chance to read those and obviously I can answer any questions. but I thought I might make just two very brief opening comments by way of introduction and context. So firstly, sir, what Matakari Lodge is seeking is essentially to remove Mr. Freeman will describe as an anomaly in the zoning of the current site to provide clarity and certainty in relation to future expansion of the lodge, subject to the identified traffic and landscape constraints which are covered in the evidence. As Mr. Freeman will note in more detail, the move from a rural lifestyle zone to a rural visitor zone is a little more important given that the definition of the rural lifestyle zone is less flexible, and Mr. Freeman will cover that. Finally, sir, I understand that Mr. Scaife and Ms. Britt addressed you yesterday and solely for the purpose of context, just like it to be noted that Mr. Scaife was the architect for the original lodge. He lived on the neighbouring property as he does now, but he was the project architect, and five of the six buildings currently on the site were designed by him. From Matakari's point of view, the only scope for future expansion is by utilising the existing site or alternately purchasing Mr. Scaife's land. From time to time there have been negotiations in that respect, of which I've been directly involved, but no mutual agreement has been secured. I'd also note, sir, the jetty was installed by the previous owners at the same time as Mr. Scaife was project architect. So with your leave, sir, I turn now to Mr. Freeman.
I presume all the development on the site at the moment has occurred by way of a series of resource consents over time.
I understand it was the original resource consent was at the end of the 90s. The Robertsons acquired the lodge in 2009, did a major upgrades of existing buildings and facilities, including wastewater, which were in a very bad state of repair, and obtained a resource consent for what is known as the owner's cottage, which is the single new building on the site. And the date of that was, remind me, Scott?
2017.
That's correct.
Okay. So in Mr. Barbett's evidence, and it may be in this statement of confession, he just says something about the resource consent application to expand the current lodge to 46 guests would result in a traffic flow increase on Farringcroft Road. Is there another consent underway at the moment, or is he actually referring to the zoning process?
The situation, sorry, I confused you with that date. The owner's cottage consent was around 2012. In 2017, there was a resource consent lodged for an expansion. That was put on hold due to a review of the three New Zealand lodges by the Robertson family. And a decision was made to concentrate on upgrading the existing facilities rather than proceeding with the resource consent at that time. But it was lodged, and landscape evidence and traffic evidence and planning evidence for that particular application, which is currently on hold, was put together by the team beside me.
Okay, so that was a wee while ago now, but it is still just sitting there on hold.
It's sitting there on hold.
But, okay, so that's presumably what was but at the moment, we're looking at the siting proposal.
To provide some clarity and certainty over and above proceeding with a resource consent and risking delay and cost. Yes.
All right, thank you. That's good. That's just clarifying that for me. Thank you.
I think Rebecca Lucas will go first. Sir.
Good morning. I'll read through the summary of evidence. My name is Rebecca Lucas. I'm a landscape architect, and I've provided a primary brief of evidence in this matter. I confirm the contents of the same. The key findings of my primary evidence are as follows. The site has a number of attributes that make it suitable for rezoning as a rural visitor zone. Such attributes include its location within an outstanding natural landscape, remote and scenic character with easy access, close to Queenstown but located away from Queenstown Gornalki Road, and existing mature native vegetation provides screening and softening of built form into the surrounding landscape. The site constraints have been identified as the existing buildings and infrastructure, the existing native vegetation as it must be maintained to ensure screening and softening of the existing and any future built form, and areas of steep and exposed topography that is visible from outside of the site, such as the terrace top that is visible from Lake Wakatipu. After consideration of the site attributes and site constraints, I consider that there is opportunity for further development of the site. The steeper and more visible slopes should be avoided, but appropriately designed development set back from the terrace escarpment is possible. A detailed site analysis was undertaken in 2017 by a consultant team, including myself. The team addressed extensions to existing buildings and tested locations for additional buildings by erecting profile poles and computer modelling to assess landscape and visual effects. A proposed scheme was prepared to incorporate the expansion of the lodge, including infrastructure, and an application for resource consent was made. This application is now on hold. It is my opinion that this proposal, or something similar, represents the maximum level of development that the site is capable of absorbing. I note that a landscape report by Dr. Marion Reid to the processing planner at the time agreed that the site was capable of absorbing the proposed development. The important attributes and values of the site and its setting were identified as a sense of remoteness, native vegetation cover, visual cohesion, legibility of the formative processes and naturalness. I consider that the attributes and values could be protected if provisions were included in the rural visitor zone to restrict location, height, density, form, materials and colours of any further development on the site. Mr. Jones in his rebuttal evidence accepts that the rural visitor zone is appropriate for the site and changes his assessment conclusion to agree with the rezoning relief sought for the site. Mr. Jones also suggests that a site-specific provision be included that requires native vegetation to be planted in the areas between buildings. I agree with this recommendation. Mr. Jones, however, is of the opinion that the appropriate site coverage should be 2,000 square metres rather than 2,500 square metres as sought, but does not provide explanation why. The 2017 resource consent proposal building coverage is 2,460 square metres, and both Mr. Jones and Dr. Reid agree that this proposal represents the maximum level of development that the site can absorb. I have undertaken a detailed study of building development on the site through both the 2017 resource consent process and this zone review process. It is my opinion that after a detailed analysis, that the site is capable of absorbing a maximum site coverage of 2,500 square metres and protect the important attributes and values of the site if the proposed zone provisions supporting landscape are included. In conclusion, the rural visitor zone is appropriate for the site with a site building coverage of 2,500 square metres and an additional provision requiring native planting in areas between buildings. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. We can estimate that though.
Yes, I'm just looking for a sense of what I dropped down to this last measure, or even last tens of metres, but approximately.
Has anyone got a ruler? I can measure, I can work it out.
I can
phone my office and have it.
I'm not worried about the exact extent. I just want a sense of it and a sense of what proportion the additional difference between existing and 2,500 is of those percentage. So we'll stop for a cup of coffee, whatever.
Yeah. Fine, sir.
So you can. So you're not doing it on the back of the envelope at high speed. Something you might regret later.
Okay.
So,